Hi, Squail, and welcome to another episode of Conversations in the Arts and Humanities. In these conversations, we introduce you to the scholars and alumni of the Arts and Humanities faculty at Vancouver Island University and discuss their latest research. I'm your host, Bryn Skibo, professor of English at VIU. Before we start, we would like to acknowledge and give thanks to the Snoqualmie, Powhatan, Tsleil-Waututh, Stanawis, and Kualakum First Nations, on whose traditional lands we teach, learn, research, live, and share knowledge. Haichka. Since 2009, the Faculty of Arts and Humanities has presented the Colloquium, a series of lectures that brings our faculties and alumni's practices and research to the public. In today's episode, I talk with Justin McGrail, Professor of Art History in the Department of Fine Arts at VIU. Justin McGrail received his doctorate from the University of Victoria in 2008. His dissertation addressed the architectural history of big box retailers in southern Vancouver Island, arguing that the buildings and their retail techniques are, quote, vehicles for the reproduction of capitalist social relations. Since then, Justin has established himself not only as a recognized expert in street art, vandalism, and graffiti, but also spoken word poetry, performing around Canada and the United States. Justin's colloquium on March 27th in VIU's Amalis Spina Theater will return to his central research focus of graffiti and urban artwork. Entitled Graffiti as Experience, Inside versus Outside Viewing, Justin's talk will address the aesthetic changes that occur when street art is brought indoors into the gallery. Today, I chat with Justin about his past and current work around the intersections of art and capitalism and the impacts of meaning over time. Welcome, Justin, and thank you for joining me.
It's a real pleasure to be here.
So in that introduction, I mentioned that you are a spoken word poet as well as an arts history professor. I have to admit, I was surprised to discover this fact about you. Can you discuss that aspect, that poetry aspect of your work?
Okay, sure. It so happened that at the very same age that I decided I wanted to be a professor, which was the age of 14, I started writing poetry. And I was very inspired by all the stuff in the rock bands and all this stuff. Poetry is what I wrote because I couldn't sing and I couldn't play guitar.
Real Leonard Cohen of you.
Yes, thank you. But then over the years, when I moved, I was in Montreal at McGill University, and incredible people all around you, I got subsumed into the poetry reading world, which I was part of saying, no, we're poetry performing. And so what we call spoken word now, which was fundamentally based on a poetry reading, was always a guy with a piece of paper or a book. Spoken word, when a spoken word poet would come up, there'd be no paper and they could look at everyone and the results were amazing. And so, I mean, I think my first public performance was 1990 at Reggie's Pub at Concordia University. And I still perform. I did a performance like a year ago, I think it was a year ago in Duncan. That was part of a spoken word festival celebration award thing. I can't remember. But so anyway, so poetry has always been part of who I am. And I've written it without respite since I was 14. It is cool. Thank you. It's fun. And I often regret not studying poetry. But then I don't regret it because I love art history. And I know that if I went to university to study poetry, it wouldn't be what I write in spoken word.
It would definitely change something. And now you've basically established yourself as a poet. Yeah. So it might
I don't need to.
Yeah, it might even kind of change for the worse. I don't mean to besmirch my poetry colleagues. We do have outstanding colleagues. But you've developed your style, your trend.
Spoken word is a distinct thing
within
Canadian poetry. That's all. Mm-hmm. We're a distinct thing. The way that we, everything about it is fine. And generally speaking, and I won't name people because they're not a VIU though, thank God. But at other universities, shall we say, have been less than kind in their opinions of spoken word. But I kind of feel like those battles are well behind us. I remember being a young poet in Montreal in the 90s and getting... Myself and my colleagues, we were proud of this. We got ripped by the editorial page of the Montreal Gazette for not being respect. For literally, you should respect your elders, basically. Like, Are you kidding? I don't think the elders wanted you to say that. That's not making the, no one wants to be called an elder.
Yeah.
So now it doesn't matter. Now it doesn't matter.
Yeah. That's my first experience with spoken word poetry was actually here in Nanaimo. And I am embarrassed to say, I forget the poet's name. She's the former poet laureate of Victoria. I think pretty recently. She was here as part of Neil Sirkan's Poetry in the Harbor series.
Right.
Anyways.
I've lost track of the poet, because even though generally speaking, the poet laureate thing is like great, and I'm always happy for young people and artists to get paid to do something. Mm-hmm. But personally, I'm just like, I'm not the laureate type, you know. Right, yeah. I miss the days when we had phones, you know. So
fair enough. No, and if this was a podcast after the fact, you know what I can do is I'll put the poet laureates who I'm thinking of, I'll put her link into our show notes, because she really, that was the first experience that her work was rad. It was just real powerful. Quick question on this. How do you view, so you are doing poetry, and I love finding this out about my colleagues, that they have these like secret projects that they're doing off to the side that's potentially unrelated to their work. So that's why I was curious. How do you view your spoken word poetry, as part of your art research, or is like wholly separate from it?
Well, it is on one hand separate from the actual research, I would say. However, and this is, it's a bit confessional in a way, but it isn't. It's so obvious that I have been a spoken word performer, if you will, since I was a kid. Like I did my first public speaking contest in grade 2.
Wow.
You know? Yeah. So I was up there in front of my whole school, blah, 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 talking about dinosaurs or volcanoes or both. I don't know.
Yeah.
You know, And I did stand-up comedy in front of my high school when I was 12.
Jeez.
Yeah, it was a lot of sympathy. It was mostly sympathy laughter, but I got it because I had older brothers and everyone was like, oh, it's the younger Grail. It's fine.
Yeah.
So I kind of have been doing that. And with spoken word, I realized I had the vehicle to take the poetry, because what I loved about poetry, I still do, is the attempt to describe emotions with metaphor, with symbols and with sound, usually, you know, in terms of how we go along. And so I find that that spoken word, that's why it kind of took off for me, would be going into that way. Now, as a result, I have to admit that I think my lecturing abilities are totally related to my spoken word abilities.
Oh,
in terms of being used to standing in front. I mean, I've stood up, I think 400 was the biggest crowd I've ever had.
Wow.
So, I was just thrown on, you know, that's just me. That's fine. So when you've got, especially at our classes at VIU, we got like 34 people. And I always have notes, but I rarely ever look at them, which is exactly what I'm like with poetry. In fact, it's almost a superstition, where it was a big deal to be able to memorize a lot of poetry in the 90s. Nobody was doing that. But it's a lot, right? And so for assurance, I would actually always have the paper copy of the poem in my back pocket or in my coat pocket.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'd never look at it, but if it wasn't there, I'd fuck up. Right?
I have the exact same thing with sheet music. I could play songs and the book would technically be open, but I wasn't actually using it. But man, you close that book, I can't play a note.
That's perfect. Exactly. You know exactly what I mean. And so with the art history lectures, when I think about lecturing in building 325, which I've done for 22 years, it's like, you know, it's not a performance. My wife tells me, don't call it that. It's not that. I'm like, you're right. I know it's not that, but there are performative elements.
Definitely.
You know,
definitely. I mean, I totally agree.
One thing, and I will say, and we should talk about the colloquium, but, is, laughter. And in contemporary art, laughter is, I always argue, it's like laughter is a great tool if you know to use it well, right? If you can be funny legitimately. And so if I can make a class of 34 people laugh about something art related, it's usually about timing. It's not about the words. You just time it right. And that comes from experience of performing a long time for like 35 years.
Yeah.
When everyone laughs, every single person is connected. And that is the moment I tell them the point of the whole lecture. If everyone laughs, I have an automatic reflex to say, okay, this is what the final's about. Because they're all paying attention.
That's great.
That's really good.
I view lecturing, because I also go up generally now without notes. Like if I'm speaking from my notes, it's because it's, you know, a really sensitive topic that I'm like, do not mess this up. But mostly I'll tell my students all the time, I'm like, we are so far off our notes. Like I'm loving this. But yeah, that importance of laughter. To me, I viewed it as, like, I'll tell my students, well, what you're watching is improv. Like, this is improv theater that we are making together. And I am up here with my cane and my top hat. Like, I viewed it as laughter is getting them engaged. But you view it as it's a really important pedagogical tool, which is such a cool way of looking at it.
Well, and what's crazy is, so I recently have, I was going to say, come down with a disability. Anyway, I've recently been diagnosed. And so as a result, I am teaching online completely now.
Woof, that's hard.
Well, it is and it isn't. I mean, I started doing it years ago, and Marnie and I talked, and I kept one class after COVID online completely.
Yep.
And so I've kind of honed that whole thing down.
Cool.
And the one thing I noticed is, because the kids don't want to put on their cameras, and that's fine. I don't make them turn on their cameras. So it's just me and a bunch of blank screens, right? But what's amazing is this. I can't perform to them because I'm not reacting to their faces.
Yeah.
When I'm in front of young people, when I'm going, and someone smiles, and then I push in that direction. It's like surfing, right? And that's the improvisation.
Yeah. Yep.
And so when you're suddenly without that, you know what? What you get? You get content. Mm-hmm. I get through so much more content. The number of tangents has dropped by like 70%.
Interesting.
So all of these elements, I think, are related, and they're all, again, tied to teaching, poetry, spoken word.
Yeah.
Oratory, you know, being oratorical, basically.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Okay, so I did promise everybody that we would talk about art and capitalism and the colloquium, so I'm going to do a bit of a shift. I was really enjoying doing research on you, not in a creepy, lurkery way, but like just finding out more about what you're up to, because of course I heard about the colloquium, but then I started finding out like your dissertation on big box retailers. I was like, this is amazing. When I first moved to Vancouver Island, I was actually really charmed and kind of surprised that Vancouver Island doesn't have an IKEA. When I moved from Vancouver, everybody warned me in advance, buy your IKEA before you get there, because there's no IKEA on the island. I'm like, that's really charming. But you were looking at the presence of big box retailers and their significance, meaning to community. You've been looking at this since 2008.
Before 2008, you know.
Obviously, yeah.
Yeah, 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 yeah. Yeah.
The dissertation was finished in 2008. Yeah, that's when you stopped. So you found that the easy argument for these retailers is that they are an efficient source for necessary goods. But in your research, you found a much more subtle and potentially graver concern. Would you say in 2020, so I would hope that you would explain what that concern is. I know it's hard to summarize a PhD in 2 seconds, but do your best. But also, would you find that that concern still stands in 2026?
The second question is one that I have been thinking about and has made me happy that I did not publish my PhD, which is I was encouraged to do. But I said no, partly because I was so sick to death of reading about that stuff. It's like if you write a PhD on a book or a work of art, you write it on stores and capitalism. Yeah. And like field trips are like you go to like Future Shop. And so it was so depressing. So I refused to, because I said, I'm not going to be that guy. I'm not going to be Canada's big box store expert. I kind of became that because as a professor of Concordia, he and I were talking at a conference and he said, you wrote that. I said, yeah. And it's a chapter on big box stores, which is in like the Canadian architectural history anthology.
Cool.
Yeah, so I've got my chapter. So I've done my part. And it's pretty good. It's pretty good. But what was interesting about big box stores, so I'm happy I didn't stick to that, because what a depressing life. But what I was getting at is that in the name of saving money, dialectically, they are providing you with multiple opportunities and incentives to spend money.
Mm-hmm.
And so it truly was, as I argued, a dialectic of value and waste. Because on every side of one, right, when you consume value, you produce waste. And yet in the era of recycling, and I used to live down from a bottle depot, so I would see people with like carts.
Yeah.
I'd be writing, and this is the soundtrack going on.
Geez.
And so that's, of course, taking waste and turning it into value.
Yeah.
And it's like one of the things I wrote about, now this is cool, and I felt that if to be honest, instead of writing this, I got divorced, that was the better move. But if I hadn't got divorced, I would have written what I called the dialectical shopping cart. Because the shopping cart, think about a shopping cart. Now, you go to the store, you go to Thrifties, wherever, and you walk in and there they all lined up and you pull yours out and that's your cart. And you put value in that item and you're pushing all this value. And sometimes you can spend up like $200, you know, without even knowing it. And you're like, great. And then it's still yours and you drive all the way to your car and you drop off stuff. And depending on how nice a person you are, but you're Canadian, so you will probably turn around and walk it back to where it's supposed to go, right? Wonderful. It is a vehicle of value. Now, shift settings. You're just driving, you know, you're parking, you live in the suburbs somewhere and you pull up and what do you notice down the street? You're on a street with no sidewalks. There's a shopping cart and it's empty.
Yeah.
It's kind of sinister because what does it mean? Who brought it there? And so it becomes a sinister vehicle of waste.
Interesting. Oh, that's really interesting. That's the dialectic.
And also, I mean, think about it. Like when you hear a shopping cart, you turn around, what the person looked like determines everything that follows.
Hmm.
If you're going to assume the person is probably homeless, you know, but what if you turn around and it's happened to me, you know, you hear it, you turn around and it's like, oh, it's just the guy from Thrifties grabbing that one, you know?
Right.
And he's in his green apron. So all of that stuff, what I'm getting at is, and this is influenced by, so my man, in terms of books, is I think this is probably the best is Lefebvre, right? So I'm Lefebvrean, and so the argument that Lefebvre theorized on, and that I argued with the case of the big box store, is that the big box store, that retail had taken over. Now it's, by the way, it's shrinking, it's changing. But during the late 80s, like basically from 70 to 2000, during that 30-year period, manufacturing was bottoming out and retail was massively exploding. And so the importance of the center for what Lefebvre calls the reproduction of the relations of production, right? That's how it keeps going. That's how capitalism keeps going. It has to keep reproducing the need for capitalism.
Mm-hmm.
And Costco was sort of, it turns out to be a perfect vehicle for that, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Because they promote such massive overconsumption that inevitably some part of your purchase will become waste.
Yes. Yeah.
You know, who needs spaghetti sauce for a small army?
Yeah.
You know, I remember when I was living with my brother and his roommates and my sister-in-law and everything, and, you know, they go to Costco and come back with like a jar of spaghetti sauce that was like, and it's like, you have to eat so much tomato sauce to eat it before it goes bad.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right.
It's almost like when we go into Costco, like I didn't live in Canada for a long time. And so then when I came to Canada and it was kind of like a mark in the relationship that you and your partner decide to join
a Costco
partnership. And we walked in and it's all, you know, new territory to me. I've never set foot in a Costco before. And he turns to me and says, well, what do you think we need? And I was like, so what you're saying makes total sense. We didn't go there for a particular value, but the thing is presented in such a way that you have to spend money to effectively feel like you're saving money.
Well, in order to join the club of money savers, you got to show some money.
You got to pay to get in.
And that kind of thinking, which is, by the way, complete con BS kind of thinking, is so American. Like that to me is that's the American capitalist sales pitch. You know, fresh, not frozen, you know, like, you know, light, but filling. Like, what are you talking about? Right. You're just throwing out words, trying to exhaust me. So I'll give you money.
Yeah. The great American paradox.
Yeah, you're just like, what the fuck, right? So Costco especially, and Costco then got involved in this. To me, is the final. This is when I was out, thank God, when I finished. But because what I was noticing was, and I wrote about, was that because of their influence, lobbyings, municipal councils, like this is such low level politics, right? But municipal councils, they run the zoning, so they determine how big your parking lot is, and blah 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 blah. There were moments of urbanism that collided with big box style urbanism, I guess. Basically, we're talking about, like, in two examples, there were streets that had been built, people were living there, these are homes, and then they decided, no, you know what, your street, we're going to turn into a cul-de-sac, and you're going to now have to get to your street. You actually have to drive up and go through the parking lot of this new mall.
Oh, wow. That's
So
wild.
retail, truly retail urbanism. Costco got to the point, and I am assuming that they fulfilled this, but whatever, that they were building condos on top of a warehouse store. And so they were essentially, I mean, this is something I've been saying for years, is that the big box store itself is brilliantly constructed because it's massive with this little structure. Like it's a big frame, big metal frame. That's all it is. And the walls of concrete were off or not poured. They're actually dropped in place. So those are what are called pop-up walls. So it is like it's real simple, that is for sure. But yeah, once it started affecting people's lives to that point, like you have a mortgage and what? You know, so things that you don't think
Having a
is going to
Costco
happen.
mortgage is, yeah.
And so there was all that.
I do want to make sure that we have time to talk a little bit about
Yes.
art. We
Yes.
don't want to give the whole
Yes.
game away, but we do want to offer a little
No,
bit of a
let's do
teaser. So your colloquium on Friday will consider street art around Victoria. And in writing public material for your talk, I mentioned some of the beautiful dynamic street art that we have around Nanaimo, especially in the Colliery Dam underpass. I don't know if you've been there before. Have you found any street art really engaging graffiti like in Nanaimo or just outside that people could go check out?
It's funny. I kind of lost track of a lot of things with COVID. So I said it detached, and plus I'm kind of older now. But there are, I mean, what I found in, whether it was at Collier Dam, there is the Maffeo Sutton Park. There was
Oh,
one
yeah.
place which I remember, I didn't go to, and then COVID happened, which is like there's an abandoned mansion, I think south of the city, that's got some great writing in it and a
Oh,
pool.
cool.
Yeah, like there are some spots for sure. It's a legitimate subculture in Nanaimo. I tend to write about Victoria because I live in Victoria.
Oh, okay.
And so, and I've been photographing and writing about Victoria graffiti since I don't even know when. Well, no, I do, since about 2010. That's when I finished the big box stores, got the PhD, and then said, okay, I'm going to look at paintings now. I don't want to deal with stores anymore. And the scene down in Victoria is really good, really brilliant, really interesting. So that's how I ended up with that. But what I want to talk to people about at the colloquium is this idea of looking at the difference between looking at painting inside or outside. And first of all, obviously, I'm starting from the position that graffiti is painting. I don't make, there's no distinction. There are a lot of people who would say, well, but no, it's just painting, man. I don't think painting is that big a deal. And that also simplifies things. And so, of course, the first the things you notice, that's sort of what we're getting at with graffiti as experience. When you're in an art gallery, think about how you walk, think about how you talk, think about how you move. It's especially true because we're Canadian that there is an effort to be extra polite. You might know the French writer Michel de Certeau, The
Oh, excuse me.
Practice of Everyday Life. So in this book, it's all about how in a society where institutions are trying to control you, how do you evade being controlled? Which is exactly what is like in big box stores and shopping malls. You have systems of control that don't necessarily control you. And in that gray zone, we have what Certeau called tactics, right? Institutions have strategies. we have tactics. These are the little things every one of us is doing to customize your own subjective experience of capitalism in the West.
Yeah.
We're doing it. You know it.
Yeah.
Right. And so therefore, when it comes to looking at art in our gallery, are there tactics we can use that will evade the shadow of imperialism and nationalism, which is a huge thing we deal with, right? Is there a way to, like establish a different relationship than the one that the curator wanted you to establish?
Yes.
I mean, the first number one step, don't read anything.
Oh, interesting.
You walk into an art gallery, ignore the text on the wall. If it's good, you can read it online later.
Yeah.
Ignore the labels. Don't read anything. Just look at the art. Second, stay in motion until a work of art stops you and demands your attention.
Cool.
Most art's terrible. Yeah, I mean, not just my art, but most art isn't very good, right? And that's fine. That's why when you get good things, it's like, whoa, right? So I remember doing this a lot in different galleries. And you just walk in and you try to walk. You're not at a normal pace, but you're not at the church at a library pace, which is what people are shuffling around in their sort of the obsequious, you know, kind of mode. You know, you want to be proud. You know what you're doing. But yeah, if something stops you, go and sit with it. Third tactic, sit on the floor.
Oh,
I learned this from kindergarten. I had 1 year, believe it or not, between teaching university. I had to get a job. So I ended up teaching art classes to kindergarten to grade five in Port Coquitlam.
Yeah.
And of course, it's like, that's a trip. But the one thing you learn about right away, because I'd be in art galleries with little people all the time, they sit on the floor constantly. Mm-hmm. And I got to tell you, that's a great place to look at art.
Interesting.
And so I regularly will, if I walk into a space and there's an art and there's a piece that I'm like, oh, I want to sit with that. I will find the security guard.
Yeah.
And I will treat that security guard with utmost respect, which is what they never get.
Yeah.
And you say, excuse me, do you mind? And you say, you ask for permission. Do you mind? It just feels more common. And if you make them feel cool, this is really important. Guys are dumb, right? Like, we're dumb, right? That's what we're like. So you just make a guy feel cool, he'll let you go do it. He'll watch your back. And then you sit down in front of a painting, and you can sit there. One painting, a Yves Klein, that was a monochromatic, it was just blue. I sat there for 40 minutes.
Wow. And it's actually that's a thing now that people are encouraging, is sitting quietly with a painting for 10 minutes. Yes. There's tactics.
I used to have an assignment at UVic. When I taught at UVic, it was called 20 Minutes, in which my contemporary art students, their first essay, they had to sit with one painting on campus. UVic has a pretty good collection of art, and a lot of it's in the library. It's like, you just find a work and you sit with it for 20 minutes and don't let your eyes leave the space. And anything you think of, you write about. If it makes you think of some dumb ABBA song, okay. Like, whatever it is, you're there to feel what you feel because you're letting this in.
Very cool.
Yeah, well, that way it's true, right?
Yeah. I am so sorry, Justin, but I feel like could have this conversation for the next 3 hours. This is fascinating, and I am so jealous for your students that they get to do this with you all the time. But that is all the time we have for today's episode.
Okay. I'm so sorry.
So thank you so much, Justin, for joining us on Conversations.
Okay. Well, just everybody, if anyone is listening, please come to the talk. It'll be really good.
So on that point, if you enjoyed this conversation, I hope you'll join us at Malaspina Theater on Friday, March 27th, 10 a.m. to 11:30, to experience Justin McGrail's visual presentation, Graffiti as Experience, Inside versus Outside Viewing. The lecture will start shortly after 10 a.m. and be followed with a question and answer session and refreshments. This is the final colloquium interview for the 2025-26 season, but we'll be back in September when VIU researchers speak on the theme of spells, potions, and enchantments being charmed or diluted through the ages. Our first presenter, anthropology professor Marie Hopwood, will consider a topic dear to, I think, many Vancouver Islanders: craft beers and their connection to ancient brewing. Check out our website, ah.viu.ca/colloquium series, for more details, or feel free to email me, bryn.skibo, bryn.skibo@viu, to be added to our colloquium newsletter. Until then, thanks for listening. You've been listening to Conversations in the Arts and Humanities, technical production by R.B. Frew at CHLY 101.7 FM. You can hear this conversation again, as well as all of our archived episodes at the Conversations website, www.conversationspodcast.ca. Many thanks to McLean, our student website editor who manages the Conversations podcast website. I'm your host, Brent Skibo. Thanks for listening.